please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Reyes, and Judge Smith. The Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this May 21, 2024 panel of our oral arguments. We do have three oral arguments today, and we have two non-oral cases we'll be considering without argument. Counsel, I'll just, well, first we'll call our first case, which is Graves v. Graves. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to make your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please keep track of the timing restrictions. They are indicated in the light and the clock in your podium, which you probably have already hopefully figured out. You can raise or lower to your height. There's a button in front if you think it's too high or too low. There you go.
Thank you.
Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep an audio recording for the benefit of the public. Whenever you're ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. Courtney Burks for appellant Hillary Mercer. In denying Ms. Mercer's motion to modify custody, the district court concluded that Ms. Mercer had failed to show that continuing the operative custody order in which the parties share custody of their two children would endanger the children's physical or emotional well-being. In reaching this conclusion, the district court erred in two ways. First, the district court erred by making a number of factual findings that are both relevant to the endangerment analysis and undercut the court's ultimate finding of no endangerment, but did not address those findings in its analysis. Specifically, the court acknowledged that there was evidence of the respondent engaging in conduct that was likely to cause his son physical harm. The court heard evidence from multiple witnesses testifying that they viewed video on social media of the respondent letting his six-year-old son use an axe to chop a rope. There was also a video posted of the respondent keeping his son in close proximity while the respondent burned gasoline off the garage floor.
Were the children injured in any of those videos at all?
No, Your Honor.
And the axe throwing one, why is that something when you've got adult supervision, why is that showing endangerment?
Well, he was a six-year-old at the time, and he was using an axe to chop a rope. And the witnesses described it as concerning behavior. And the court also recognized that the court considered this to be concerning behavior.
But concerning is different than endangerment, though, isn't it?
Well, endangerment is likely to cause harm. So there does not need to be harm that is actually caused. But reckless conduct that could cause harm and is likely to cause harm is relevant to the endangerment standard. The court also recognized that Ms. Mercer had been granted a harassment and restraining order against the respondent, for which he had violated multiple times and served jail time for violating. And the court also acknowledged that the respondent had attempted to, or had interfered with his daughter's individualized education plan, which had shown to have a significant improvement in her reading ability.
When you say interfered with the plan, yep. He disagreed with the plan, right?
He disagreed with it, and I think it's important to think about the context of how he disagreed with the plan. So the respondent in this case, he filed affidavits and said that the individualized education plan constituted child abuse, and that accused Ms. Mercer of committing child abuse while being supportive of the plan. And there was a document in the record where the respondent wrote that he had complained to the school saying that the school was violating his daughter's right to equal education under federal law.
Sure, I understand that. I'm just trying to get us in context.
Okay.
There's a difference, at least in my mind, and you can disabuse me of my concern if you think I'm wrong, but a difference between a child having a plan that's in place and then a parent interfering with the operation of the plan versus a parent who just disagrees that the plan is appropriate for various reasons, whether it's characterized as abusive towards the child or violation of rights, however it's framed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recognize the difference between those two or not?
No, I would agree that there's a difference. I think parents can disagree on a lot of things about their children, including whether an education plan is appropriate or not. I do think the fact that the respondent in this case continued to try to interfere with it even after it demonstrated success and got the respondent up to speed. There was testimony from the vice principal at her school that the daughter had sort of gotten back up to her appropriate reading level on the plan. And so I think the OMBET case that we cite in the brief is sort of bolsters this sort of idea that in that case, the mother, I believe, had, while the child was in the custody of the mother, there were a number of tardies and absences at school, and the district court found that, you know, while the tardies and absences had not impacted the child's sort of education or her performance at school in any way, it still was something that could likely interfere with it, and then that was relevant to endangerment.
On that, I haven't seen any, I didn't gather the details of the acts incident. Was there any dispute that Mr. Graves was present at the time that the child was using the axe to cut a rope?
He was present. Yeah, there's no dispute that he was present.
Is there any allegation that the child was using the axe in a way that was likely to cause, that was misusing it or wasn't under appropriate instruction?
That was not in the record. It was just testimony from multiple witnesses that viewed the video and said that they felt that it was concerning and unsafe from what they viewed.
Right, but there's no, right, okay, I'm just, but for the court to reach a determination that it was unsafe, is there anything more than conclusory statements by individuals who looked at the video as to the behavior that would suggest the child was in danger?
There's nothing, and also the district court didn't explain why, even though the district court described this conduct as concerning behavior, the district court didn't explain why it didn't come into play in his endangerment analysis. You know, the court didn't say, you know, the witnesses testified to this as concerning, but there's no evidence or, you know, that, but I don't view this as being, you know, inappropriate for a child of his age and under the appropriate instruction. There was sort of no explanation as to why this evidence didn't make it into the endangerment analysis.
Understood. I mean, obviously Minnesota and other places where there are different parents have different approaches to when a child might be ready to use knives, axes. Some parents are rural, some people take their kids hunting, fishing, using sharp objects, knives at an early age. I'm just wondering whether there's something in the evidence that would suggest that this was particularly dangerous behavior in the way it was conducted. I'm gathering that we have people that were observing it, but no one described it in a way that would inform the court either way.
That's correct, and I don't believe the video itself was in the record either.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yes, yes. My concern with your position is that Judge Johnson has been on this case for some time. And what you're asking us to do is find that he abused his discretion. What's your best argument for the fact that he abused his discretion here?
Sure. And actually, this case can be framed as legal error as well. So in the Hassine matter, which sets out the test for endangerment, and in that case, the district court made clear that, so I guess stepping back, the statute requires the court to address whether the child's present environment endangered the child's physical or emotional health. And in the Hassing case, the court held that the present environment means the entire amount, it includes the history of care back from the time of the last judicially created custodial arrangement up into the time of the modification hearing. And that case said that the district court must consider all relevant evidence that occurs during that time, and a court can't disregard that evidence. Now, in the Hassing case, that I believe I read that to be decided through an abuse of discretion lens, and I think that's actually sort of a really good case to approach this case through, but in terms of legal error and the misapplication of law, I do want to say that recently in the Sublett v. Schultz case, this court held that when a district court misapplied the Hassing standard by disregarding certain evidence that occurred in the history of care, that was legal error. And so I think it can be viewed as either a misapplication of the legal test that this court set forth in Hassing, or it can be an abuse of discretion because the district court disregarded substantial evidence. I think that just depends on whether this court thinks the district court correctly stated the legal rule and, you know, disregarded substantial evidence, which would lead to an abuse of discretion, or if this court simply misapplied the law by not addressing or considering all evidence in the history of care. So the latter would be legal error, and the former would be abuse of discretion.
Well, don't they both fall under abuse of discretion standard? Isn't that really the overarching standard that we have here? And a court can, district court can abuse its discretion by making factual findings that are clearly erroneous or a legal error, such as the one that you're outlining. But isn't that still really analyzed under the abuse of discretion? And then underneath that, we look at particular claims that are made.
Okay. Like it's an abuse of discretion to misapply the law.
Correct.
Okay. Yes, then that would be under both prongs, then, that we would argue that the district court abused its discretion. But in terms of looking at the evidence that the district court disregarded and, you know, didn't properly analyze, I do think the Hassing case is sort of particularly instructive because there, the district...
Two different issues you're conflating. Oh. I just want to make sure. You argue that the district court misapplied its findings in reaching its conclusion and also separately failed to consider other pieces of evidence. Am I correct that those are the two?
Yes.
Those are different. They each have different... standards, correct? Standards of review?
Whether the court misapplied the law or whether the court ignored substantial evidence?
Reach conclusions that don't derive from the facts. That your first argument seems to differ, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you think the same standard applies to both.
So we're arguing that even though the court included some fact findings in its order, It essentially disregarded them in its analysis because the court, in doing its endangerment analysis, it focuses on sort of a very narrow time set of the, you know, parenting supervisor, or I'm sorry, the individuals who had supervised parenting notes for about an eight-month slice of time out of the 3.5 years.
Let me push back on that a little bit. And you, again, and just challenge me if you think I'm wrong in my assessment of it. As I read the district court's order, it seems as if the district court was right. It's very thorough. Seems as if the district court was recognizing that for some period of time, Mr. Graves was under professional care based on a diagnosis that turned out to be, in the minds of later professionals, wrong. And the treatment was not effective because it wasn't therapeutic on the one hand, and it was a misdiagnosis on the other. I got the impression the district court saw that there was a change likely to occur, or the district court found a change likely to occur based upon a proper diagnosis of PTSD chronic versus the previous diagnosis of manic depression. Am I correct that in that interpretation of the district court's decision, and if so, why wouldn't that be a justification for the district court to focus on more recent events rather than the previous events?
Sure. Well, first I would say that there was no connection between the respondent's medical health treatment or his compliance with medication or whether his diagnosis was accurate and his showing that connection to that with respect to his judgment, with respect to his behavior with his children or his wife. His behavior through the relevant history of care, which is from November 16th, 2018, up until the time of the modification hearing, which is about a 3.5 year period. His behavior was fairly consistent during that time in terms of his sort of erratic behavior with respect to his kids. I mean, about a month before the hearing, he filed a number of affidavits continuing to accuse Ms. Mercer of child abuse. So there was no actual change in behavior during that time frame. And then with respect to a prospective, you know, assessment of whether the respondent, if he gets the correct medical treatment, can change his behavior in the future. That sort of violates the Hacine rule, which says that you have to look back at the history of care, because the history of care is what likely or what is going to inform the present circumstances under the endangerment analysis. So the court here thinking if the respondent is compliant with his medication and he's likely to comply with court orders in the future, that's answering the wrong question because it's looking forward. And also turned out to essentially not be correct because the court eventually stayed its order after the respondent violated the court's order. And there was some evidence. That's post. I don't want to bring in information that's not in the record. But ultimately, the respondent hasn't been able to comply with court orders. And that's why the test is to look backwards at the sort of history of care. And then I do want to address, I see my time is running out, but our second sort of argument was that there's a number of sort of indisputed conduct that the respondent engaged in that the district court did not address at all. So including the fact that at the time of the modification hearing, his 13-year-old daughter had not voluntarily spent parenting time with her father for a year.
Well, we have that in your brief, and because your time has expired, I'll just point out that the respondents on notice that you're going to be making that argument. So during your 5 minutes, you can give more detail. But we have the list in your brief.
Yes, you do.
So thank you.
Thanks.
I'm just making the point. You haven't waived that at all. So respondents on notice that the respondent will need to respond to that as well, not just your first argument. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the court, I think...
You could state your name and your party you represent.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me. It's been a while since I've been here, but I do like coming here. Stephen Harris, I'm for respondent Richard Graves. I think, Your Honors, where I want to start is some findings that are in the record that... appellant is stuck with, okay? Appellant has not come to this court and challenged any of the district court's actual findings as being clearly erroneous. So at addendum page 5, paragraph 14 of the district court's order says, Ms. Mercer similarly testified that Mr. Graves did not exhibit physically threatening behavior around the children. Ms. Mercer testified that she never witnessed or heard any incidences between Mr. Graves and the children that endangered the children in any way. Mr. Graves' unpredictable behavior was her original cause for concern, which Ms. Mercer believes to be a symptom of Mr. Graves' prior bipolar diagnosis. The district court went on and paragraph 21 at addendum page 8. Ms. Mercer argues that the circumstances have changed primarily because Mr. Graves has failed to remain medication compliant due to his prior diagnosis of bipolar. His failure to comply with medications consistent with that diagnosis, his mental health and behavior have changed. What's clear, and there's pages in the district court order that Judge Johnson talks about Mr. Graves' mental health, and I think Judge Ross, you get it that he was misdiagnosed, has bipolar and PTSD. But the district court, and these are the findings that the appellant is stuck with, says that the whole reason we're here was the appellant's concern about Mr. Graves' mental health.
Well, that's probably accurate in a big picture scheme,
yes.
But when you dig down to it, it was I think the allegations were more specific than that. That was a general overarching concern, but there were specific concerns that were raised: disruptive and uncooperative conduct, causing one of the children to be kicked out of summer camp, permitting the very young child to use an electric hedge trimmer. and other conduct that, flowers sent to the daughter saying your dog is dead when the dog hadn't died. There was specific conduct that was the basis for the concern, that, and some of that the district court didn't address at all. Shouldn't we be concerned that the district court just gave an overarching response rather than specifics, particularly regarding some of these troubling behaviors?
Well, again, I mean, I would encourage the court to look carefully at paragraphs 14 and 21, which I just recited. So my sense of that, Your Honor, is that before the district court, it was the mental health concerns that stimulated the motion, and that's why the district court spent so much time with it. And these other issues, I agree, some of them are not dealt with in the district court's order, except that the district court ultimately concludes that none of it meets the high standard of endangerment, showing, you know, actual harm to the children. So, the fact that the district court finds at 14, Ms. Mercer testified that she never witnessed or heard of any incidents between Mr. Graves and the children that endangered the children in any way. Appellant is stuck with that finding. Appellant doesn't challenge that finding. So their very arguments that they're making today are inconsistent with the finding that they're stuck with.
Well, I thought the argument was in part that if you look at the facts that the district court did find, that the conclusion, part of which you've just read, is wrong. I think that is the argument, even though it's captioned as a finding of the district court.
Yeah, I would agree with Your Honors that lawyers and judges sometimes confuse findings of fact with conclusions of law, and they get mixed up. There's a conclusion of law in the findings, and there's a finding of fact in the conclusions of law. That happens. But overall, the district court, and I think Judge Smith pointed out, Judge Johnson knows these parties. He's the one that signed the original stipulated court order, which that court order was for shared physical and legal custody. And that court order, which was stipulated to by Ms. Mercer, the appellant, was that it was in the best interest of the children to have that custodial arrangement. So when Ms. Mercer brought her motion in November 2021, the burden was on her and always has been her to, number one, show a change in circumstances. That's one element that you have to meet to modify custody. And then under her arguments, to show endangerment. So the change in circumstances apparently was Mr. Graves' mental health situation.
When was the YMCA incident?
I'm sorry?
When was the YMCA incident? What year was it?
I can't speak to that directly, Your Honor.
Let's assume that there were no allegations of mental health. There's no evidence of mental health, and all you had is one parent saying, listing the things that are listed out on page 26 of the appellant's brief that the district court didn't address, which is that a parent sends flowers to his daughter saying, your dog is dead, and that's not true, lets her know that her room at his house has been given away to refugees, and if you want to come in, you've got to come in through the window. There's a video depicting himself and his children, or one of his children, shooting Nerf projectiles at a board entitled White Churches, White People's Churches, and a narration that says, we have plans and a target. And the daughter runs away because she feels unsafe and she's locked out of her dad's house. He's disruptive, gets her kicked out of a YMCA camp, and he permits a young child, a six-year-old, to use an electric hedge trimmer. And that's all we've got. And one parent says, that's evidence of endangerment. And the district court, whether it's mental health generated or not, the district court includes no findings specific to those particular incidents, wouldn't that give us reason for concern? If not, why not? And by concern, I mean, wouldn't that be a basis for us to redirect the district court at least to address those issues?
Well, I would acknowledge the Court of Appeals certainly has that the Court of Appeals cannot make findings of fact on its own. So my argument is that appellant's argument is there's apparently not enough meat on the bones. But I would say that the bones are there and they have some meat on it.
But how do you address what I just described, though? So why does it matter that it's captioned within a mental health diagnosis if on top of that you have very specific conduct that whether it comes out of the mental health, I mean, maybe she's wrong that it comes out of a mental health diagnosis. These are behaviors. Why shouldn't the district court have to at least address those behaviors in deciding that there's no endangerment?
Well, I think the parties were married for, 14 years prior to the divorce, if I'm getting my dates right, in 2018. The district court, obviously, Your Honor, you're right, it didn't speak to YMCA. That's not anywhere in its order. But obviously, the district court concluded that none of that arose to the level of endangerment.
But the district court didn't discuss those things. So how are we to know whether the district court considered them apart? You're saying, well, the district court must have considered it as saying, well, this was just all about misdiagnosis. But my question is that a fair way to characterize the allegations as the case developed when you have these specific incidents of conduct?
Well, the district court, and this is at addendum page 20, said, aside from one incident between respondent and Aurelia, the daughter, mm-hmm. in 2019, the circumstances surrounding which were unclear from the testimony, neither party presented evidence to show any specific instance that rose to the level necessary to show endangerment. So, yeah, I the district court didn't discuss YMCA, but the district court's conclusion is clear. You add it all up, it doesn't amount to endangerment. And the district court had discretion to make that judgment call. What appellant is arguing is legal error and saying misapplied the law. The appellant is saying that if you have YMCA, that compels endangerment.
You keep referring to just YMCA. I listed five different things that the district court didn't discuss.
And, no, but appellant seems to be arguing YMCA, dog, IEP, they all equal.
Flowers.
Yeah.
You can't come into the house. Your room's been rented out to somebody else.
Right. But appellant is saying that it's legally mandated. That all, the Court of Appeals or the district court legally was compelled to make a finding of endangerment based on those facts, and that can't be the case.
I think on these facts, the argument is, the ones I listed, the district court has to at least address them, and the district court seems to have ignored them. And your argument is, I guess, the district court didn't ignore them, just didn't list them out, but considered correct. Them, but just didn't decide that they were enough
didn't,
for endangerment.
Didn't feel they were material enough, Your Honor. And, I mean, the Court of Appeals is not here to retry the case and substitute its judgment for that of the district court.
But we still have to be satisfied that the district court did consider that information and may have found it not rising to the level of endangerment. But what is there in the record to show that the district court at least considered that information, those facts?
Well, what Your Honor, what I can point to is what I just read at addendum page 20. So in other words, by absence of YMCA, the district court obviously concluded that it was not material or did not show endangerment. And
you would agree that it's material, though. The things I listed are at least material to endangerment.
I don't know that I would, Your Honor. Just take the IEP as an example, which I think the court questioned appellant's counsel on. The IEP thing and disagreement about that, I see that kind of thing and disagreement in divorce cases all the time. So to have a disagreement doesn't equal...
I'm talking about the other things, though, that seem to be...
Well, there was no... Keep in mind here, what appellant's brief doesn't point to... this is the Ms. Mercer saying this is her conclusion of endangerment, mm-hmm. which obviously differs from Judge Johnson's conclusion, non-endangerment. So there was no testimony in this case. If you look at the other side of cited Sharp v. Bilbro, there's no testimony that I'm aware of like children's psychologist that came in and testified that this constitutes endangerment or that the children were actually harmed. In Sharp v. Bilbro from this court in the year 2000, the endangerment in that case was supported by the mother's psychological expert, and the court held that the mother's perceptions of reality interfered with her ability to parent. We don't have that kind of testimony here. We just simply have the mother's assertions that this happened or this is a fact, and that equals endangerment.
But don't we have a little more than that, because the daughter is not seeing her father at all now? True?
I don't know the current status.
The record shows that she was not visiting her father at the time of the hearing and hadn't for a year.
But everything has all been, the daughter is 16, 17 now. Everything was all under court supervision. I mean, there were temporary orders that suspended parenting time. So, the court, in its order, ultimately what it did, at the end of its order, is it ordered a transition period. I'm not going to be able to find it right off. It ordered a transition period in terms of upping Mr. Graves' parenting time. So the court recognized that there was lack of parenting time with the children, and we're going to consult with a PC or psychologist, and we're going to gradually up it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you. Courtney Burks for the appellant. I do want to just address a couple of the arguments that the Respondent's Counsel made. So with respect to paragraph 14 that he highlighted in the addendum, which includes the district court's order, we did address this in our brief, but we think that the district court's styling of Ms. Mercer's testimony regarding her witnessing endangerment, that is a legal conclusion, and the purpose of our appeal is to essentially dispute that legal conclusion. It was not a proper finding of fact. And then with respect to paragraph 21, we would also dispute that that's a finding of fact, because it's stylizing Ms. Mercer's argument regarding circumstances have changed, and it shows Ms. Mercer's, opining on perhaps that's because of Mr. Graves's failure to be medically compliant, but Ms. Mercer is not a medical expert when it comes to Mr. Graves' mental health issues and how that could impact his behavior towards his children. In terms of the position that the respondent has taken with respect to how much work does the district court need to show, I think the Hassing case is both extremely on point in this case, both in terms of the legal standard it sets out as well as the district court's analysis in that case and what the Court of Appeals said was insufficient. So in Hassing, the district court considered 4.5 out of 5 years of history of care. And it left out the last 6 months before the hearing. And the Court of Appeals reversed and said that the district court had acknowledged in its order that during the last 6 months of the history of care up into the hearing, that there had been evidence that undercut the district court's finding of endangerment, but that the district court had failed to address those findings in its conclusion. And In the footnotes, the Hassing Court said, you know, we note in the trial court's findings and memorandum its consideration of the appellant's care of TS during, quote, the entire time of period of her custody, end quote. Although these references can be read to suggest attention to the end of that period, the immediate child care situation, we cannot read that meaning into findings in light of the court's clear choice to refrain of refraining from examining the child's immediate circumstances. So this kind of the sweeping language of a district court saying, I have considered everything, and I don't find that, you know, I don't find what I've heard to be persuasive. This court in Hassing reversed and said, that's simply not enough. You know, the appellate court needs to be sure that the district court has actually considered all of its relevant evidence presented to the district court. I do want to also address, I know that Respondents' Counsel noted that there was no child psychologist or sort of expert testimony attesting to whether the minor children have suffered actual harm. And in this court's case of Heckle v. Heckle, which was decided May 30th, 2006, this court said that expert testimony regarding endangerment is not required. You know, the testimony through the documentary evidence, and as Judge Smith pointed out, that, you know, the elder child's fear of, there was evidence of her being afraid of her father, of not willingly spending time with him. Ross v. Ross stands for the proposition that a child who is over the age of 12 who no longer wants to spend time with one of her parents, that is indicative of endangerment.
In that case, just said that there has to be a hearing to deal with endangerment, and we had a hearing in this case.
That's right. So
it wasn't our court didn't say that this is a child's decision not to be with a parent is itself endangerment.
That's right, but it is relevant to the endangerment analysis. And so in that case, the court decided, or it was reversed, the decision was reversed because the district court had not found that there was a prima facie case that led to a hearing. But it's still the principle of the relevance of a relatively older child's preference relevant.
But in this case, the court, I mean, the evidence was there, and the district court said, well, there's not enough here for endangerment. So why wasn't that already factored in the district court's analysis? You're saying it wasn't because it wasn't specifically discussed.
That's right. There was no, all of the evidence that you had listed out that's in our brief, there was no discussion of it, no explanation as to how that evidence that undercuts endangerment sort of plays in with the court's ultimate conclusion. And we think that Hassing stands for the proposition that a district court is required to address that evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. Matter is well briefed. Thank you for your briefing and well argued today. Difficult decisions always in these custody cases. We will carefully consider the arguments presented, both in writing and oral argument, and issue our opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted under advisement. Thank you.